Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is an encore performance of The Brian Lehrer Show today, so we won't be taking any phone calls. We're bringing you the entirety of our May 5th Green Space Show, the very first from WNYC's brand new Jerome L. Green Performance Space. We hope you enjoy it, and remember, our comments page is always open at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and guess what? As you can hear, we can have company now. So good morning, everyone. We are doing today's show from WNYC's brand new Jerome L. Green Performance Space on the ground floor of our building at 160 Varick Street in Lower Manhattan. We've got Paul Krugman here, who we will talk to in just a minute, but we are so excited that the green space is now completed and now open. We hope to use it for this program as kind of democracy's living room here in Lower Manhattan. Now, as I said, we can have company now, and we hope to have all of you over, about 100 of you at a time in our cozy new place. If you're listening near a computer, you can watch this show today. Yes, radio, you can watch, as we are streaming live video of this event at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. For those of you not near a computer, the green space is both cozy and high-tech. We've got about 100 to 120 seats, depending on the event. The stage is so low, we can be close to the audience for a lot of interaction. We've got windows to the street where I can see out and people can see in. Though, yeah, we've got a couple of people with umbrellas standing out there. Hi, out there. And we've got lots of multimedia capacity. So again, if you're listening near a computer, you can watch this show. Radio is a spectator sport, as we are streaming live video of this event at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And if you're in Lower Manhattan, come on by. You can look right in the window and see us at 160 Varick Street at the corner of Charlton, just below Houston Street. I also want to acknowledge two special audience members this morning. My parents, who have come in to watch the first Brian Lehrer Show from the green space. Mom, Dad, you want to stand up? And thanks for putting up with me when I was a teenager. You know, they used to say, do your homework. How else will you make it to the green space? But did I listen? Sometimes. New York Times columnist and Nobel Prize winning Princeton economist Paul Krugman is our first ever Brian Lehrer Show guest here in the green space. His recent book is called The Return of Depression Economics and the Crisis of 2008. Dr. Krugman, thanks for making this tiny little piece of New York history with us. I really appreciate it.
That's great. But you do need more screaming fans outside the windows.
Definitely.
We need better weather.
Maybe you can arrange that for us next time. Audience, how many of you read Paul's column in yesterday's Times? Oh, wow, so many of you. Okay, well, those of you who did, don't vote in this poll we're about to take. For the rest of you, here's a little thought experiment. Imagine you're an employee at a company that employs 100 people. The boss comes to you and says, because of declining revenues in the recession, we either have to lay off 10% of you, or you all have to take a 10% pay cut, and you can save everyone's job. How many of you would say, no pay cut? If you didn't read Paul's column yesterday, if you don't know the answer, his answer, how many of you would say, no pay cut, go ahead and lay people off if you have to? That's a big zero out there in radio land. How many of you would reluctantly, you know it's going to hurt you, but you'll take the 10% salary reduction to avoid the layoffs?
There we are.
Applauding, raising hands. So, Dr. Krugman, what's the answer?
You know, if you're one of those 100 employees, the audience made the right decision. The problem is if everybody in the economy does it, it actually doesn't do any good at all. In fact, it does harm.
That's so we would have, and you put it so starkly yesterday, that in order to avoid unemployment is the reason that people were doing this, right. But it would actually wind up, you project, in more unemployment nationwide in the long run. Make that case.
Yeah. The reason, of course, it doesn't do any good if everyone does it is, you know, the point of getting a wage cut is so that your company becomes more competitive, it can sell more, can gain market share, or at least hold on to it. Of course, if everybody gets a pay cut, then nobody gets more competitive. The only thing that happens is that everybody's income is down, but, you know, debts are not down. So people are owing just as much on their home mortgages as before, but they're making 10% less. And furthermore, to the extent that people think that there are going to be more wage cuts in the future, then who wants to spend now because things are going to be cheaper in the future? So it's like a rise in the interest rate. So between the debt effects and the interest rate rises, this, you know, economy-wide wage cuts actually makes everybody worse off.
And so is that, would you call that part of a deflationary spiral?
Yeah, it's you know, debt deflation is one of the terms people use. Yeah, but this is, you know, this is all familiar. Wages fell by about a third during the opening phases of the Great Depression, and that didn't do anybody any good.
So what do you recommend for individual groups of employees faced with that decision? Because this has happened in company after company.
Yeah, but I mean, this is the same thing as consumer spending. You know, everybody cutting back because they're worried about their budget is actually doing harm to the economy. But, you know, it does make sense. Individually, you got to do what you got to do. And the same thing here. So I'm not actually making a recommendation to individuals. This is a recommendation aimed at Congress and the White House saying, get this economy moving before we get into this downward spiral.
All right. Audience, how many of you who said you would take the pay cut have already changed your minds? You haven't quite convinced everybody.
But, you know, in effect, not that I was actually involved, but I have, you know, at the Times, New York Times is getting a 5% pay cut for everybody. And I'm in favor because we want to keep the Times going. But, you know, I'm aware that collectively this is a bad thing.
It is tough to make the macroeconomic decision when you're an individual human being.
That's
right. We never seem to have a shortage of really gripping economic news these days. This morning, it's the results beginning to leak out of the so-called stress tests on the 19 major banks, and reportedly about half of them will need more capital to be ready for more potential bad news in the recession without going insolvent. Do you have an impression yet of what these results mean?
I only know what I'm reading in the papers. I'm not getting any leaks. And by the way, I have to say that there's something off about this process. You know, first of all, why is so much leaking? And the leaks have the feeling of being trial balloons rather than, you know, genuine information. And it's almost as if they're saying, you know, how good a result can we announce while still seeming credible? It almost feels like the Treasury Department is negotiating with the public about, you know, how Pollyanna-ish, how optimistic can we get away with being, rather than, you know, that may be unfair, but it's certainly nothing that's happened so far inspires confidence that these are really objective tests.
You mean you think there might be a different result announced officially on Thursday, because I guess that's when they come out, than it's being leaked today for Wells Fargo or any other particular bank that might need more?
Oh, no, I don't. I actually think that they will make sure that the last round of leaks sounds like the real thing, because that would be a very bad thing for the market if it wasn't. But I think that I don't know any of this, but the feeling is that what they really wanted to do was say everything's fine, except nobody will believe that. So they're marking down what they're saying, but not, we don't know how much of that is really objective.
Why would that be their goal? I've heard you say this before. Why would the Obama administration have an incentive to make things look rosier for these big banks that, let's face it, people are really angry at, rosier than they really are?
Because if you say that the banks are in really bad shape and they need lots more capital, which they can't actually raise, then it's up to, you know, to the Obama administration to find a way of providing that capital. And that's tricky. It's actually very difficult to do without basically taking over some of the major banks. And they have been really, really reluctant to go that route for a variety of reasons, some good, some not so good. But it's, you know, it probably requires also that they go back to Congress and say, you know, we actually need more money to fix the financial system. And they don't want to do any of that, so they'd like to pretend. They'd like to paper it over.
So you think that these stress tests are going to come out like the children in Lake Wobegon, where all the banks are above average?
Well, I've actually said that, or it's like a class
of
self-esteem,
quote.
Where everybody, all children are good just in different ways. But
are you saying the stress tests are fundamentally dishonest? Because if so, why do them?
Well, you know what's interesting. I think first of all, I don't think it's going to come out quite as glossing over as I feared, because the public reaction. The informed public reaction has basically said, you can't do this. You can't just whitewash it completely. But why did they announce the stress test? It's turned out that the tests themselves have placed a lot of stress on the administration. But I think what they did was it's not clear that there was that they actually knew what they were doing, right? It was, there might have been different factions, one of which actually wanted to use the stress test to say, look, these three big banks are we need to take them over, and another group that wanted to just buy time and hope that the whole thing went away. And so I think it was not a well-thought-out strategy.
And I am confused about some things, like Wells Fargo is supposed to be one of the banks said to need more capital to be safe, according to these leaks, but they reported their best quarterly earnings ever just last quarter. Can you make sense of that for me?
You know, quarterly earnings can represent all kinds of things. There's if there's one thing we should have learned 7 years ago from Enron, it's that an earnings statement doesn't necessarily give you a very good picture of what's happening. And there's a lot of funny things in the way banks can do it. So a lot of their earnings depend upon how much they're setting aside for future losses. And Wells Fargo said, oh, we're not, you know, we think things are good. We don't need to sell a lot. You know, a lot of people were puzzled by their results there. My favorite, I think, was still, I think it's Citigroup, where the way the accounting rules work is that the value of your bonds, the value of the money that you owe, goes down because people think you might go bankrupt. That gets counted as a profit. So.
Nice.
So the earnings don't really tell you anything.
Anybody in the audience have any questions for Paul Krugman on the banks, on stress tests or the banks? Think about it for a minute. If you do, raise your hand and we'll get a microphone over to you. Optimism about the stress test led to a big rally in bank stocks yesterday, and the Dow is back above 8,400 for the first time since mid-January. Wall Street Journal front page today, trumpets how stocks are in the black for the year. So do you think the worst of this scary recession might actually be over?
I guess the answer is define worst. Look, I mean, what we were worried about, you know, before this hit, what we were worried about was not Great Depression II. We were worried about Japan and America. We were worried about a lost decade, a prolonged weak economy. For a while, it looked like, oh, my God, it actually could be Great Depression II. That's still a possibility, but the scary, you know, everything falling apart all at once, that pace seems so slow. Things are still getting worse, but they're getting worse.
Because you were among those predicting the possibility of depression.
No,
you think
possibility.
Well,
it's still a possibility, but no, I mean, I was worried. But, you know, when the actual concern in my book, Return to Depression Economics, is about is not about really a depression depth slump, but about an endless slump, Japan style. And that's still, there's nothing I've seen that makes that risk recede. All that we've seen is that the falling off a cliff, the Wile E. Coyote moment, as we say, where when you start looking, notice there's nothing under you, and go boom, that may be coming to an end, but there's still no end in sight.
We had better than expected construction and home sales numbers yesterday. Another reason for yesterday's 200 plus Dow gain. Front page of the Times today has an article about how places that saw the housing crash early in their communities are seeing glimmers of recovery.
Well, the prices in the places that had the biggest bubbles are now back to more or less historically normal levels. So you'd expect, but it's one thing to say that home prices may stop plunging, although I think they probably still have a ways to go down here in New York. The numbers say that. But it's another thing to say that we're going to have a recovery of, right. Nobody's building houses.
Let's go to the audience.
Good morning, Mr. Krugman.
Good morning.
Regarding the stress test, going back to September last year, we had a banking crisis that was not only an American crisis, a global crisis. Right. We went through a weekend when the whole system nearly collapsed. Do you think that the reason for the administration introducing the concept of the stress test was over a period of time to restore public confidence in the banking system?
No, actually. Because they're not stupid, and they know that simply them having the administration declare that the banks were okay is not going to necessarily convince people. What they wanted, the stress tests were actually a response to growing rage over the way taxpayer money was being used to rescue banks, and a growing demand from many people, myself included, that we say, what are we getting for this? Are these banks... are we just propping up insolvent institutions? Are we just essentially turning this into a welfare state for bankers? And the stress test is supposed to elucidate which banks really are okay and just need a little bit more, liquidity backup, and which ones actually need some form of at least partial government takeover. So it's not really about reassuring the markets. The stress test is about reassuring Congress, reassuring the taxpayers.
And I don't get at least one thing. We're told that half the big banks may not have enough money to get through the next few months. But this is received as good news, and the market goes up. What am I missing?
I think what's happening is that the market sees that the chance that we'll actually have temporary nationalization of big banks is receding, which is, by the way, this is not necessarily good news for you and me, right? If the market, the price of Gotham Group, that's my favorite imaginary bank now, the price of Gotham Group stock may go up because people think that the federal government's going to allow the management to run wild for another year. That's good for the stock price, but not good for the economy.
Which investors make that judgment? All right, we'll continue with Paul Krugman live from the Green Space in a minute. Remember, you can watch a live video stream of this event at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. I hear the audio on that video stream is not working very well right now, so you can watch the video and listen to the radio, and we'll continue in a minute. All right. Why aren't you Secretary of, what was he going to say, defense? Singer-songwriter Jonathan Mann, who is posting a song a day to his YouTube page. That one from a few weeks ago, his ode to Paul Krugman, my guest here at WNYC's Jerome L. Green Performance Space. How come you're not in the Obama administration? Were you asked?
No, I wasn't, but I made it clear in advance that I wasn't interested. And you have to know who you are. If you've seen my office, you would know why I should never be given administrative care. I think I do better. Look, I probably got as much voice in the discussion as I would if I were in any position other than Treasury Secretary. And believe me, you don't want me as Treasury Secretary.
You've been critical of the president for not being aggressive enough with his bailout bills and other things. Do you still think that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have this is the crisis of our lifetimes, maybe the crisis of two lifetimes. And what we have is a response that is helpful, is mitigating, but it's falls well short of guaranteeing a recovery. My big concern always has been that we will basically go down the same route Japan did in the 90s, that we'll do enough stuff to avoid catastrophe. We've actually already had a worse slump than the Japanese ever did, but not enough to actually boost the economy back up.
Other people say Japan had stimulus bill after stimulus bill after stimulus bill during that decade.
Yeah, they did, and they were all too small. And there was never, it was kind of stop-go to a stimulus. Then say, oh, well, we should pull back a bit. Then, oh, well, let's do another. And that's, that's exactly the route. The banks, the Japanese did, stuff to keep them from failing, but not enough to actually make them healthy. And guess what we're doing? So I'm suggesting that maybe we should be a Timothy Geithner song, because it is kind of feeling Japanese right now.
Jonathan Mann out there in San Francisco posting your songs to YouTube. You hear that? Maybe a Timothy Geithner song next. The Chrysler bankruptcy. As President Obama was announcing it last week, he took this shot at some hedge funds and other investors.
They were hoping that everybody else would make sacrifices, and they would have to make none. Some demanded twice the return that other lenders were getting. I don't stand with them.
Was the president right to go after some investors like that, and is Chrysler in general being well handled by the Obama administration, in your opinion?
I think he was right to go after them. There is, we're trying to, this is very tough stuff, and the last thing we need is a lot of people trying to hold out for, trying to be free riders and everybody else's sacrifices. I don't know that the hedge funds are unique as being villains. There's a lot of villains out here, but sure. There's no such thing as handling this well. The auto thing is a mess. The Chrysler deal looks like a pretty reasonable stab at trying to, maximize your chances of minimizing the damage, if I can say that. It's not great, but I don't know that I could have done better on this one.
About criticizing those investors, the Wall Street Journal editorial said on Friday, to hear the president tell it, you'd never know that Chrysler had borrowed and since frittered away the $6.9 billion that it owes to those, quote, speculators. The administration had only offered $2 billion to those secured creditors as part of its proposed restructuring for the carmaker, so it's hardly a surprise that many lenders would rather take their chances in bankruptcy court.
But they didn't really want to take their chances in bankruptcy court. They were hoping for a buyout. And look, this is a bankrupt company. It is, in fact, a bankrupt company. What the administration was trying to do was to do a workout that would avoid a formal bankruptcy, but, you know, achieve the same and more smoothly. And look, you know, the Wall Street Journal, it's a funny thing. You know, they're all in favor of free enterprise, but they don't actually really want people to actually lose money, or at least not their friends to lose money. So it's what can you say?
Now, the Journal also complains that the UAW will now own 55% of Chrysler, even though they've just been a junior creditor, while the senior creditors, the same investors, get 30 cents on their dollar. Is that just Democratic Party politics giving spoils to the union?
No, it's an attempt to save some piece of the company. Let's just be clear, right? This is a, we're at great risk of having the irreversible loss of this company. And that may happen, but you really want to give it a chance, particularly since we know that auto sales will not always be as low as they are right now. You want to give a chance of getting through this thing. Giving the workers a large stake in this is probably one of the few ways you might have a way of lasting through it.
So you think it's a strategy, not politics. But on Sunday, you were on ABC this week on their roundtable, which also included George Will. And here is George Will asking a pointed question about the UAW as majority owner.
If the UAW is going to own 39% of General Motors, and the government's going to own 50%, how do you negotiate? Since you've got a government in part elected by the UAW negotiating with the UAW. And then there's Chrysler. If Chrysler's going to be owned 55% by the UAW, is the UAW on both sides of the table when they negotiate a contract?
Gee, you know, we have the government negotiating with creditors, a lot of whom give large contributions to politicians, and I somehow don't hear George Will complaining that that's got the banks and the investors on both sides of the bargaining table.
Well, what about UAW on both sides in the Chrysler case?
Sure, but remember that in some sense the ultimate stakeholder here is in fact the U.S. government, because the U.S. government, its credit line, its aid is essential to this thing. So this is no more than you're dealing with now a partially worker-owned firm, of which there are a number. You know, this is not unique in America, and this is only a problem if you think, oh, unions, scary, which I guess is the way that some people do think.
So, audience, now that we, the taxpayers, have a stake in these failing auto companies, raise your hand if you think we should make the automakers build cars that will be more profitable than the ones they've been making during their decline. No?
Oh, well.
Paul, okay, a few hands, just a few hands. All right, now raise your hands if you think if we think we should direct them to produce greener vehicles, hybrids, electric cars, things like that. All the hands. And now raise your hands if you think the greenest vehicles are the most profitable vehicles. No hands. Paul Krugman, wait a minute. Here again is your friend George Will with you on ABC.
I assume the president is talking about the Prius. It's affordable because Toyota sells it at a loss, and it can afford to sell it at a loss because it is selling twice as many gas-guzzling pickup trucks of the sort our president detests.
Is this a catch-22 for the taxpayer-owned car company?
You know, I think there's a limit to how much you want. I'll show a little sympathy for George Will here. You don't really want the U.S. government, you know, even though it'll have an effect control, trying to serve too many objectives. It shouldn't be directing the auto companies to make stuff that's going to be money losing. The thing about the Prius, though, you know, they're not doing this. They're not selling this car at slightly below cost out of concern for our health, or they're doing it because they think they're building a market position in what will be a highly profitable niche of the market. So it's actually, in their calculus, it's actually a profitable thing, even though the current losses, it's an investment. And we should say that these things fit together, right? We're supposed to have a climate change policy coming in. Once we actually do have cap and trade, once we actually do have a policy on climate change, the calculus of what kinds of cars sell is going to change, and you want to get ahead of that. That's exactly what, of course, the Japanese are doing.
Is that how you square the apparent paradox in our green space audience here? Everybody wanted them to be forced to build cars that are greener, but nobody thought those cars were going to be more profitable than the cars that they've been building. So how many of you, let me try one more, how many of you would care if the auto companies continue to lose money while they build these green cars? Would you care?
Yeah.
Yeah, you care. So none of this squares.
No, it's not. The thing is to look ahead. The problem with the auto companies is they've had a strong tendency. I mean, one of their many problems has been a strong tendency to look back. You know, there was a long period when they kept on. Back in the 80s when they kept on making cars with station wagons with fake wood on the side because they thought people wanted the stagecoach look. And they've been building, they committed themselves entirely to gas guzzlers when, in fact, if you look ahead, it's clear that we're heading for policies that are going to make gas guzzling uneconomic.
Quick questions for Paul Krugman about the automakers. Any car questions? If I assume that the Paul Krugmans and the George Wills of the world are both sincere in your views, how are we non-economist laypeople supposed to figure out what kinds of policies to support during crazy times like these?
Boy, this is always a problem. You get people on both sides. Now, I think one thing to ask is can you check facts? Let me say that the Times seems to be a lot more insistent on requiring corrections when you actually get your facts wrong than the Washington Post does. I don't know how to deal with that. I mean, I try to be credible. I try to be careful. I try to be right also, if I can. But there are conflicting voices. I think one thing you can do, I mean, let's not make this about George Will. Let's make it more generally. So if we take something like climate change. You will hear lots of people on both sides. You'll hear impressive-sounding discussions. It is helpful to take a look at, where is it coming from? And there was a study done of research questioning whether climate change is happening, and what fraction of it was actually funded by the energy industry. And the answer is 100%. So that's the kind of thing you need to look at.
Paul Krugman is the author, most recently, of The Return of Depression Economics and the Crisis of 2008. New York Times op-ed columnist on Mondays and Fridays, right?
That's right.
And he's going back to Princeton now to grade senior papers.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot for coming in. Please thank Dr. Krugman. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, live from the Green Space. Coming up in just a minute, we'll conclude our Cityscape series with New York architect Liz Diller.